And I can remember at school, the teacher, he'd just read this publication in the daily paper, how we were committed to war. And I couldn't hold myself, and I just said, bawled out, "I'll be there." And that was in 1914 when the war was declared.
An Australian soldier recalling his entry to the Great War, a war that quite simply changed the world, a brutal, deadly triumph of mechanical modernity and an imperial bloody-mindedness. A war that redrew the map of the world, that gave birth to much of our world today. But 100 years on, that experience is remote. It's lost a little in time. What was the reality of the First World War in men and machines? Now, a world first. A touring exhibition from the Imperial War Museum in London has arrived in Melbourne. It's only Australian port of call in what will be something of a global tour. Joining me now is curator of that exhibition, Samantha Hayward, and a principal historian from the Imperial War Museum, Nigel Steele. Welcome to you both.
Hello, hi.
Nigel, the Imperial War Museum was set up to educate future generations about that war. An exhibition like this in this centenary year, that's sort of a fulfillment of a destiny in a way. It's
Absolutely. A
moment.
Yeah, no, I think it's one of the things that's been really pleasing for us is that not only were we set up to make sure that future generations understood and remembered the First World War and what happened and what its impact was on the lives of the people who took part, but Imperial War Museum was specifically set up, and there's a kind of clue in the title, the Imperial bit, it was about the British Empire, it was about all those countries. And so it's really pleasing for us that 100 years almost after we were actually founded, we've been able to pick up all this stuff and bring it to Australia and hopefully then take it on a succession of countries to actually show the people in those countries the kind of storyline that we've been collecting and building up for the past 100 years, because that's been our job.
Samantha, how hard is that to distill a collection like that and to put it into boxes and send it across the world, to make something coherent from so much?
Right. It's difficult. It takes a lot of time. I think most people are amazed at how long it might take to create an exhibition. But it's also great fun and a privilege.
I mean, this has been quite a few years in the making.
Well, this particular project, we started work on this in the summer of 2013. But by that point, the Imperial Museums had already been working on a lot of First World War content for our own new permanent galleries down in London, and we were also working on a couple of temporary shows at the same time on First World War content. So I was able to work from quite a lot of other people's research from the museum, who'd already been looking into, you know, what uniforms we had, what personal stories we could tell, what amazing objects they'd found that we had, some of the original provenance, you know, who had given them to us, the backstory to it and so on.
It's an interesting having the pair of you here. It's sort of two disciplines here, which I suspect, Nigel, it's complementary sense of what these artefacts represent.
Yeah, I think the two of us work very well together, because whereas Sam has put together a kind of understanding and a picture and how it's all going to, how the tour is going to go, it then comes to me to check things out and find information and fit the objects into the history and make the history flow through as a single story. And so you can do both together. And we found ourselves, since we've been looking at the exhibition that's been laid out in Melbourne, seeing things real for the first time, kind of telling each other little bits that matter to us so that we actually can pick up on the different parts of it. And it has been a good process, I think, and it's been useful to be able to draw on years of kind of knowledge and information and things that we've done on past projects. I mean, I'm a First World War historian, and I've done lots of things for the museum in different contexts, and so I kind of pick up all of that, little bits of oral history, little bits of provenance, little things I remember from way back that we looked at before, and have brought it into this exhibition, which is really nice.
What's the story? I mean, what do you want people to walk out of this having in their head about that war?
I think what we want them to understand is the enormous scale of the war. I mean, this was a huge global undertaking, and it affected millions and millions of people in many, many different countries. And I think rather than looking at this as the telling of a national story, and often say with, say, the War Memorial, the War Memorial's job is to tell Australia's part in the World Wars, whereas this is actually looking at the bigger, wider picture. It's trying to look at a human story and fit those national experiences into that big picture. And so we want people to get the scale and see the mechanics of it. How did it work? This is the first time there'd been a major industrialised war of this scale, drawing in vast levels of production, of manpower, people keeping it all flowing. And it's not just about men at the fighting fronts. This is about, they could not exist without actually all the people back home, men and women, producing all the material and the goods and shipping it across.
That's an extraordinary part about that war, Samantha. As a triumph is the wrong word, but as a moment in modernity.
There are a number of historians now who would say the First World War is really the start of the 20th century. It ends this kind of long 19th century Victorian values and the way of life, and the dominance of empires actually from Europe. It's the beginning of the end of that. It's the beginning of the end of the dominance of the royal families. You know, you think about how many royal families were governing Europe, and therefore in those days parts of the world too. By the end of the First World War, that's all swept away, or very much under challenge, you know, as the way in which the world is going to be run. And of course we now have a different kind of set of political elites, but nevertheless, you know, that was a real sweeping away of an old order.
And in that war too, Nigel, we had that, the birth of the capacity to eradicate people on such a scale.
Yes.
That's one of the shocking things. I think this is what you can actually feel, is the huge numbers of people who get killed. And we have a section in the exhibition which looks at the very first moments of the war, where France and Germany in particular kind of square up to each other along their borders and in Belgium, and they have thousands of people killed within the first few weeks. And for Australia, this process is delayed. But when it comes about, and the Australian army, the soldiers, arrive in France and they go into Pozières at the end of July 1916, it's the same process, and it's the same guns exacting the same toll on these people. And I think the shock...
My grandfather among them, I should tell you.
We'll say the shock for the whole of Australia, yeah. I think, was the same as it was for the rest of Europe. And so that process, although it may be delayed almost 2 years, is the same. And it's the same realisation that the mass production of shells and the ability to fire extremely quickly, this prodigious quantity of explosive power, is one that really means that human beings are stopped literally dead in their tracks.
And I think that this impact of so many dead, but also so many missing, you know, okay, there's dead and there's something to bury. Because of this firepower, there are many people who are never found. You know, their bodies don't exist in any recognisable form. And I think that, if you like, psychological shock or impact for their families who are directly involved, but also their friends and relatives and so on, I think that's what really is another part of this. You know, it's the dawning of the 20th century, is that it's the beginning of a different attitude towards warfare. You know, warfare was a way of conducting your political... ambition.
And the concept of mass destruction, I guess,
Yes, we start to understand how clever and sophisticated the human race is now, that it has found multiple ways in which to destroy itself. And, of course, we get the next version of that in the Second World War. But the first, I think, sets this different attitude towards warfare.
At the Museum of Victoria, a travelling exhibition from the Imperial War Museum looking at the centenary of World War One. Talking about that on Sunday Extra. Samantha Hayward is its curator, historian from the museum. Nigel Steele is with us too. And Nigel, that's an interesting thing in the comparison between the two, that there's still, despite the mass nature of casualty and death within the First World War, there's more of a sense of human scale, of individuality in that as well, that seems to sort of be lost in warfare since.
Well, I think that's been a nature of our collections at the Imperial War Museum since we were set up in 1917. In the following year, Britain produced its first ration book in October 1918, and on the back of one of those pages was an appeal from the Imperial War Museum to ordinary people for small-scale souvenirs, small little things that actually set themselves in the context of this bigger picture. And so I like to think that the exhibition will lead you through the big questions, these big issues. But when you get to the end, the final section, you see these small individual showcases looking at the impact on the lives of those families. And I don't think it matters that somebody may have been telling this story for a a man who went to war from London and was lost to his family, because it could be somebody who came from Perth, it could be somebody who came
from
Adelaide.
It's a universal tale.
It is. It's a human story. Mm. And I think IWM does that. And the other place that we try to show this in the war is that when the trenches take hold, when this kind of paralysis of movement happens at the end of 1914, because of the power of artillery to actually drive people literally to ground, they get stuck in a trench system. And at that point, whilst they're waiting for the big battles to take place, there's a daily life that goes on. And part of that is patrolling and going out into no man's land just to check things out. And at that point, you could meet face-to-face, the distance that we're talking today, just at two arms' reach.
Yeah.
And whoever acts first, whoever is strongest and boldest, is the one who wins. And we have a selection of knives and trench clubs, and these are brutal medieval weapons, which shows that this is a war. It's not a smart war. It's not a war fought off map references. This is at many, many times a time when it is face-to-face, man-to-man, who acts first. And that's a very, very brutal and chilling concept.
How does the exhibition deal with all those elements, Samantha? I mean, from the big machines to the smallest personal detail, what are the juxtapositions there?
You've just answered it. We juxtapose them. I deliberately needed to show a cross-section of our First World War collection. I think it's probably the best collection in the world for the First World War. We have such a variety, and we do have, you know, enormous weapons of war. We've got a 60-pounder in there, which is the largest object we've transported and are touring as part of the exhibition.
Explain what a 60-pounder is, I guess. Not a hamburger, I'm assuming.
No.
The 60-pounder is the weight of the shell that it fires. This is a heavy field artillery piece that was fairly common across the Western Front. So it's bigger than the average one that would be pulled by horses. Yeah. You'd need a special truck to pull it.
Yeah. 7 metres long, something like that. Big, heavy.
And it's quite surprising when you come around a corner and there it is, because touring shows normally have relatively small pieces in it, but this is a big, big thing.
Did that have to be busted up into bits to be...
No.
It was toured as a single piece.
In fact, we can't take it apart. That's one of the guns we couldn't take apart, so it's toured as a single piece and took us 12 hours to get into position in the galleries. Juxtaposed against that, we've got very tiny items of the very personal sort that Nigel's just described. Mm. In that particular area, it's not the tiniest item, but one of the items that I can think of that you probably wouldn't expect to see is a rather beautifully beaded snake made by a Turkish prisoner of war, you know, in exchange for food. And it's just lying at the bottom of the case, and you can see that and this enormous field gun at the same time. We've also included works of art from our collection. The Imperial Museum and the British government and various other committees commissioned artists to record what they saw. And they commissioned different sets of artists. There were, if you like, established artists who were asked, because they were already well known, and can you paint what you see on the home front, for example.
Some that made their reputations in.
Yes. And then you have a different set of artists who are, as you say, much, much younger. They're not that well known. However, you know, they're sort of starting to make their name in as a futurist or a vorticist, so some real modernist painters. And actually, a number of those end up being both a painter and a soldier. And so you get a different perspective on what they're trying to tell you in their paintings. And then you get other people, other artists who want to produce paintings that reflect on the war. So they are less documentary in style, but they are much more reflective of what they feel.
And
the meaning
in the spaces between those sorts of elements, great room there for the imagination to draw the connections.
Yes.
And to help people do that, one of the things that we've done, because I think the most important thing is to bring this subject alive for people in a way that if it's just a static object in a glass case, it doesn't always do it.
Mm.
What we've done, and this has been a fantastic collective effort, in that we've made these animated films. There are, in each of the principal areas, so the war on land, the war at sea, the war in the air, we've got a 2-minute story on an enormous 4-meter high screen or a 4-meter wide screen, which looks at one episode. And between that, there is just a general ambient screen which looks at the nature of that war. So there's kind of like water as it trickles along with ships in the background between these shows. And these screens are all linked together, and these have all been animated by an Australian company, and the sound has been added by a company from Switzerland. And we've done this in kind of repeating 24-hour cycles.
We wrote the scripts.
And what they really do is they kind of inject into it, for people who don't quite have the context, the sense of the way that all of these objects all fit together. Mm-hmm. And it creates a kind of evocation of that historical moment. I'm really, really pleased with the way these things not only work in their own right, but how they work as a sequence. Mm-hmm. And so people, when they're going through that, should be able to see that. And that's what you can do as a kind of modern institution, is you can take creative technology, everything that's available today in terms of the digital opportunities that are there and actually add that to this solid, reliable historical evidence you can produce and make it a much better show.
I'm hoping you both have a favourite thing in the exhibition, because I'm going to ask you.
Well, I've got some, yeah.
What's yours?
There's a bit towards the end where people often say, well, okay, you get locked in the trenches, how did it come about? Well, 3 years of learning produce a learning curve at which finally the armies in 1918 are able to overcome it. But they have to overcome this incredible barrier of defensive networks. And we have a showcase which is packed with machine guns, and it's meant to look like a wall. And so for me, the machine gun wall is one of the things I like best, because I've spent 25, 30 years explaining to people how the process goes and how you have to go through and what that is. And that is the obstacle that the Allied armies, led by the Australians and the Canadians, force their way through this wall. And so to me, to have it represented almost literally as a series of showcases with these machine guns all pointing at you, they give you something of the threat and the danger. For me, the wall of machine guns is one of the best things there.
Samantha?
I think my favourite story really has to be Albert Baker. He is in the last final area of the exhibition, which is talking about the end of the war, how people try to commemorate or grieve or rehabilitate or rebuild their lives at the end of the war. And Albert Baker is one of those stories that could stand for so many families around the world. He's a young man who enlists in the army. He's sent out to the Western Front. He's killed at the Battle of the Somme. He's 19. He came from a family of four other children and a mum and a dad living in South London. Just an ordinary family, you know, very ordinary everyday family. But he's the eldest child and the son, you know, and handsome too. And he writes a last letter, you know, in the event of my death, which the family decide to, we think, print for his funeral service, because they've sort of reproduced it on paper, printed, but it's black edged. And the letter itself is heartbreaking, you know, as a 19-year-old boy writing a letter to his mum and dad in the event of my death, which is the essence of it is, you brought me up so well, I'm so grateful, and I hope to meet you on the other side. Here's what I want to give to each of the other children in the family. You know, and it goes right down to my stamp collection goes to Eric, who's the baby. What I think is really sad about that story is that from what we can tell, the donation came to us relatively recently through a friend of the eldest daughter, so Albert Baker's sister, Margaret, who had died with no children, and these precious things that she'd kept, you know, his photographs that he sent back from the front and postcards, and we've got his cigarette holder that his dad gave him. You know, can you imagine being sent away to war and your dad's given you his cigarette holder and a little tin for your tobacco? And she'd held on to that for so long. Because we don't think that there's any descendants of that family left. He died, his family were devastated. There's a terrible, heart-wrenching photograph of his parents going back to visit his grave, because, of course, that's something that also happened. You know, people started saying, well, I want to go and find the headstone. I want to see the place. I want to lay a wreath. And what you can see in that photograph is that I think it's about 10 years or so since he had been killed. It's probably a bit less, actually. And they look twice the age that they do in the photograph that's taken of him when the family's all together just before he goes away, and he's standing there in his uniform in the back garden. But we think, you know, after that, the family kind of scattered, and so they all the siblings lost touch with one another. We don't think there's any descendants.
A tremendous thought to pass those things on to the museum and then to us to be seen. Thank you to you both. Sadly, it can only be in Melbourne, but people can travel around this country to see it.
Absolutely.
Museum Victoria, it is the World War One Centenary Exhibition from the Imperial War Museum in London, and its curator, Samantha Haywood, and a principal historian from the Imperial War Museum, Nigel Steele, have been our guests here on Sunday Extra. Thank you to you both.
Thank you very much.